Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Pam Genoff, a New York Times best-selling author who's out with her new novel, The Lost Girls of Paris. Grace Healy is a grieving widow who's late for work. She cuts through the train station, Union Station in New York in 1946, stumbles over an abandoned suitcase, looks inside, and she's intrigued when she finds a packet of a dozen photos, each of a different woman. She learns the suitcase belongs to Eleanor Trigg, who was just killed in a car accident outside the station. Her intrigue leads her to discover who Trigg was and who the women in the photos were. Pam, there's the old adage that sometimes the littlest decision in our life can affect so many things. What made Grace decide to open that suitcase in the first place?
Well, Grace is a very interesting character. She is what I call not quite a war widow. So she lost her husband during World War II, but not to combat. She lost him in a pre-deployment accident. And she's living alone in New York City in 1946, wrestling with her grief and guilt and trying to figure out what comes next. And I should say she didn't want to be in the station in the first place because it was really a focal point for the tragedy that she'd experienced. But she's forced by a detour to cut through the station, and she sees this suitcase. And I think her first impulse is natural curiosity of this kind of abandoned suitcase and what is it doing there. But very quickly, when she goes to sort of try and identify whose suitcase it is, she finds pictures of 12 girls inside. And she's really sort of perplexed and curious as to who these women are. And so it becomes not only a journey to find out about the women, but also kind of a way to find her way back to herself.
Well, just thinking about it, if I found an abandoned piece of luggage in Union Station today, there's no way I'd even think of going near it, let alone opening it, right?
Right, you'd call security. And Grace does think, the war just ended. Could this be, an explosive device? But I guess it was a more innocent, gentler time, I suppose.
Well, the women in the photos, they were all characters inspired by real people, right?
Well, I always say my book is inspired by actual events. The women that I portray are composites and are fictitious, but they are inspired by the real women who served Britain's special operations executive.
And that special operations, the women that served in that group, there wasn't so much espionage as it was sabotage and subversion, as you've put it. What is the distinction?
Well, that's actually a really important distinction to me. I'm glad you focused on it. So if you think of traditional spy work or intelligence work, that is the gathering of information and people who can be your assets and that sort of thing. Sabotage and subversion are different. Sabotage was going behind enemy lines and, say, disrupting a factory of German production or blowing up a railway line or anything that would kind of slow the Germans down. And then subversion was liaising with the partisans and the local population to build resistance support. And both of these were intended to sort of weaken the Germans ahead of the Allied invasion to make the invasion more successful.
Was this group of operators exclusive to Europe, or were there American equivalents?
There were certainly American equivalents. I have not researched them as much, but there were Americans who did this. But SOE was unique in it was its sole mission was the sabotage and subversion, originally undertaken by men, but later by women in significant numbers.
What inspired them to do this type of work?
Well, SOE was created by Winston Churchill in the darkest days of the war. So if you think back to 1940, before the Americans have entered, Britain's being bombed, the battles are not going particularly well, and the traditional intelligence agencies like MI6 had some fumbles, some pretty serious intelligence issues that didn't play out well. And so Winston Churchill created SOE, in his words, to set Europe ablaze through the sabotage and subversion.
Eleanor Trigg in the story was inspired by a real-life character named Vera Atkins. Who was Vera Atkins?
Vera Atkins was a very interesting woman. She actually was not British. She was of East European descent and from a Jewish family. But she came to work at SOE in London and rose through the ranks. And when they made sort of this women's group within SOE, she was put in charge of the women's unit. And so she recruited the women. She sent them to their training. She deployed them. And then ultimately, when many of the women were captured and killed, Vera Atkins felt a great deal of guilt and responsibility. And she went over to Europe to find out what had happened to the women.
So how dangerous was it day to day for the women in the SOE?
so dangerous that at one point they said the average expectancy for an SOE agent who went over to be a radio operator was something like a few weeks. I mean, it really was, you know, what happened was as SOE became very successful, they rose to prominence on sort of the radar of the German counterintelligence, and the Germans made it their mission to capture and, you know, destroy the SOE agents, and Hitler himself had issued an order saying, like, no mercy is to be given. They're to be slaughtered to the last man or woman. And so when the Germans captured the SOE agents, first of all, the women had no official military status, which, you know, made their position more precarious. But the Germans had a program called Night and Fog, Nacht und Nebel, and under that program, they would make the worst enemies of the Reich disappear without a trace. So these people were killed without records.
With it being so dangerous, was there a huge financial incentive for them to take this gamble?
That's an interesting question. I did quite a bit of research into how much these women were paid, although the exact amount escapes me right now. It was certainly significantly more than they would have made in their run-of-the-mill shop or office job, clerical job. But if you think about it, that's not going to do you any good if, you know, you're killed. So I don't think finances were the primary motivator. There was, you know, patriotism or a sense of duty. In some cases, if their families had been killed, there might be a sense of revenge or, you know, living for someone. Different motives.
We're talking with Pam Genoff, author of The Lost Girls of Paris. It's available now wherever your books are sold. Pam, how complex was your research for a novel like this?
Well, I write, this is my 10th book of historical fiction, and they're all complicated in different ways. So some books you might be struggling to find material. That was not the case for this book. For this book, there is actually a great deal of nonfiction that has been written about SOE. There's a wonderful book about Vera Atkins called A Life in Secrets, for example. So for this project, the challenge was when to stop, because there were just so many stories of heroism and these incredible things the women had done that I could have gone down that rabbit hole of research forever and never gotten to the writing.
I've had actual biographers tell me that they feel like they actually know the person that they're doing a biography of. Did you feel that sort of kinship with Vera Atkins?
You know, the funny thing is, you know, I don't set out to write Vera Atkins. I set out to write a fictitious character like Vera. And so I might be different than the biographers in that way, in that I almost don't want to get that close to the real people because it would compromise my ability to create the fictitious character.
Something I found interesting about Grace is she's experiencing this grief. How does solving the mystery of the lost girls aid her in her grief?
Well, it aids her because in some way she's able to bring light and recognition to the lost girls of SOE and almost save them in a way she couldn't her husband. The other piece of this is that Grace wasn't entirely comfortable in marriage, and so she also has some guilt from that after he passes, and she's trying to figure out what is next. And I think through kind of the mission of finding out what happens to the girls, it helps her put her feet on a new path.
A lot of your writing is set in World War II. What draws you to that time period as far as a literary subject?
My love of the World War II period comes from experiences I had just over 20 years ago. I was a diplomat for the U.S. State Department, and they sent me to Krakow, Poland, and I spent 2.5 years there, almost 2.5, working on Holocaust-related issues that had never been resolved, and I became very close to the survivors who were still living in that part of the world. And so I was so changed and transformed by those experiences that I decided to write about them, and I regard my books as sort of love songs to the people who lived through that horrific era.
I've got family in Poland. That's where half of my family is from. And so it always intrigues me when people who visited there, because I never have. What unresolved Holocaust issues remain to this day that I don't think normal people just read the newspaper day to day would even know about?
Well, what happened was when Poland came out of communism in the 1990s, there were issues from World War II that they had never been able to resolve because of the Cold War and communism, where their free speech was stifled and they were cut off from the West. And so in the mid-1990s, issues such as preservation of concentration camps, restitution of Jewish property, and anti-Semitism were just literally frozen in time. And there has been, since then, since the 90s, a good deal of progress on those issues and moving them forward. But obviously, you know, the political climate and there can be troubling messages of anti-Semitism in the country, these are still very much issues at the fore of a country that, you know, has only been a democracy for a few decades.
When you're there as a diplomat for the State Department, are you there as the mouth of the current administration, or is this just a longstanding policy of the State Department to help resolve these issues?
Well, I was there. Now, Foreign Service officers are not political in their job. They're, you know, career Foreign Service officers. And that's different than when I was at the Pentagon. I was actually a political appointee. But state, I was, you know, a Foreign Service officer. And so the reason our government was interested in these issues is Poland at that time was seeking to join NATO and the European Union. And politically, it was important that they make progress on their issues from the war before that could happen.
One of the themes of this novel is people trying to do the right thing when it's not the popular thing. And I think that runs against the grain of how we're taught, and because every politician that thinks they're doing something thinks they're doing the right thing. But how can we relate to this whole idea nowadays when people are running against the grain of a government that's actually doing the wrong thing?
It's a really interesting question. There's a theme in this book, and I don't set out to write themes, but these themes come up. And a very important theme in this book to me is the trust that we put in our government as citizens and whether or not that trust is warranted. Because these agents, you know, went believing their government was doing what was right for them and query whether that always happened. So if we look at what's going on in the world today, I do think it's a very timely theme.
You're a law professor by day. And as a writer, I know you can't control when ideas pop in your mind. You ever been in the middle of a lecture and an idea pops in your mind and you have to put aside evidence or whatever it is you happen to be lecturing on and jot down this idea?
Well, I do. I'm on the faculty at Rutgers Law, which I love. And I love the combination of the solitude of writing and, you know, the interaction of teaching. It's a wonderful synergy for me. I should be so lucky to have ideas pop up. I don't mind because I can just jot them down and then save them for writing time. So I've never sort of walked out of my class and said, I have to go right now. But, it, ideas come when they come, I agree.
As a law professor, I went to law school, and as law professors, a lot of times are not the most creative people because they're reading the same script that they've read for year and year, teaching civil procedure. You're a very creative person. Does that translate into lectures and make them more interesting?
Thank you. I find our whole faculty is really creative in the way that they're innovating and flipping the classroom and bringing real-world experience to teaching. For me, there's a great synergy between creative writing and legal writing, which is one of the subjects that I teach. For example, there's a whole field of applied legal storytelling and how you tell a client's story. I can bring from the creative writing side to my students some techniques about how to jumpstart creativity and know themselves as writers. And then what the law has brought to my creative writing is actually the ability to revise. You know, I took that from practice with me.
And part of that revision, I would assume this book is probably twice as long when you got done with it, and you have to tighten it up, right?
Well, there's some people who are short writers that have to expound, and there's some people who are wordy and have to cut down. I think it's very much a personal style. I'm on the short side, so I hand something to my editor knowing that it's going to have to be beefed up.
Is that right? Well, then, as you do that, does that require more research, or is that more creativity that goes into it?
Well, it's interesting, both. I'm a contemporaneous researcher, so I don't do all of my research ahead of time. I do a bit, and then I can kind of research on a need-to-know basis, which is pretty useful. And so it might be an additional piece of research, or it might just be going deeper into a character or restructuring, perhaps.
What a fascinating insight into your process. The book is The Lost Girls of Paris by Pam Genoff. It's available now wherever your books are sold. Certain to be a New York Times bestseller. And this, if you haven't read The Orphan's Tale or anything else Pam has written, read it because they're all fantastic. Pam, excellent book. Thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Thanks so much for having me.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.